Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 127, recorded Monday, February 20th, 2017. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: critiquing my top 10 travel tips and reviewing VPNs. Coming to you from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois, in the midst of my fourth straight week at home. It is yet another sign of the impending apocalypse. All just can't be right with the world. The office manager is nervous that I'm in the office for days in a row. My friends are shocked that I'm available during the week for a beer. My wife is tired of cooking dinner for me. And the cat is visibly pissed, in his own little kitty way, that I'm taking up space on the couch. But I am getting current on things like my doctor and dentist appointments. And actually, I was able to get a haircut in a timely manner. Though these may seem little things, they can be a pain to get done when you're traveling every week, and weekend appointments are a very scarce commodity. Convenient, if a bit boring. It also means, though, that I've missed one Delta and two United system outages and the associated ground stops and cancellations, as well as I missed getting stranded in the weekend before last's East Coast winter storm. So those of you who follow me on Twitter have got to be happy about the lull in bitch tweeting. And I've also been around to provide real-time advice and counsel to my wife as she's been planning our family spring break trip. This year, we're skipping the Iberian Peninsula and going to Paris. I'm not sure how much she really appreciates my immediate feedback, but, the house is awash with guidebooks. Except, of course, Rick Steves. I've pulled out the 2016 review copy of DK's Top 10 Paris. The credenza looks like my wife cleaned out the local library, and we have printouts of a bunch of web pages, and we've got different colored sticky, notes and post-it notes. I don't know. I guess I'm a visual and tactile person. When I'm trying to wrap my head around a bunch of disparate data sources, I just have to go physical, print it out and spread it out. Or maybe that's just a fancy way of saying that I'm getting old. Following up, so just a heads up before we get into it, I'm going to be announcing a new giveaway later on this episode, and if you actually really want to cut to the chase, you can go straight to the Travel Commons website, and the top post, the most recent post, will have the giveaway, and I'm using Rafflecopter to collect the names and do the raffle and do the random choosing. So if you want to cut to the chase, there it is. Because with regards to this podcast, since I can't figure out how to create MP3 chapter marks in Adobe Audition, if you're listening to the podcast, you're just going to have to listen all the way through. So anyhow, rummaging through the mailbag, Dan Granwald dropped me a line. He was agreeing with my complaint in the last episode about the small print size on most hotel shampoo and conditioner bottles. Speaking of getting old, and like me, he likes the Hyatt Places solution: print a big number 1 on the shampoo, a big number 2 on the conditioner, and a big number 3 on the shower gel, because that's typically the sequence that you use. No need then to wear your reading glasses in the shower. Dan also said that he really liked the music in the last episode. I got to tell you, Dan, I cannot take credit for that. I outsourced the music search for the last episode to my daughter, Claire, who was home from university on winter break. And since she received what I think may be the first and only positive comment about music on this podcast in 12 years, I have asked her to help me on this episode also. Longtime listener Robert Fennerty hit the Travel Commons website to comment on my pay-as-you-go SIM travails. From I mentioned in the last episode, Robert says, not many people are courageous enough to admit what a time sink it can be to find, purchase, and set up a local SIM card. Sometimes it's easy, the many Heathrow SIM vending machines being a great example, and Austria is just a breeze. But outside of Western countries, I've had to hand over my passport, stand in long lines, and try to explain, no, I need the one with data, to clerks whose language I don't speak. Once I found out after leaving the store that my SIM was not properly initialized, so, you know, please go back to square one. The Verizon Travel Pass is a great alternative for those 2 to 3 day trips. It's often less expensive than the local SIM, and it's about as painless to enable and disenable as you can imagine. Please keep up the good work, Robert writes. The beer tips and the warm sentiments from the road, your podcast has become an old friend that I have over for dinner every once in a while. Well, Robert, thanks for the post. And that's really kind of a nice way of putting it, the podcast becoming an old friend. I hadn't heard it put that way, but that's a huge compliment. Thank you very much. You know, looking at SIMs for our Paris trip next month, the new upstart network provider, and I forget their name off the top of my head, they sell their SIMs through vending machines. So I think I'm going to try and skip the Orange phone store and give these new guys a try. And since we're in Paris and not going out into the countryside, I don't think coverage is going to be that big of a deal, or coverage gaps is going to be that big of a deal. I'm not a Verizon phone customer, but many of my Verizon using friends swear by Travel Pass as just being dead simple, like Robert says. AT&T finally matched that offer last month. Back in January, they announced their International Day Pass, $10 a day, and it looks about as simple. And an AT&T using friend who will be on an Asian cruise next month plans to use it. And, you know, that just seems to be the perfect use case. He's going to be in a different country every day, as opposed to us in Paris. We're landing in Paris. We're going to be in Paris the whole time, I think about 11 days, and then we take off. So for us, the local SIM is going to, it's going to, even if I've got to spend an hour in the Orange store, it's going to be worth the investment. Now, one of the things we will be working on before the Paris trip is not to forget anything critical when we leave for the airport. Many years ago, we got out of the cab at O'Hare's International Terminal for a family trip to London. I'm pulling the bags out of the cab trunk, and 1, 2, 3, 3. There was one missing. So I send the family through to check-in and boarding while I hop back in the cab, run home, open the front door, and there's the forgotten bag in the middle of the hallway. Now, we live only about a 25-minute drive from O'Hare, and luckily there was no traffic, and I had status on Virgin Atlantic at the time. So I made it to the gate just before boarding was called. So that memory just sort of has been seared in our brains. We'll never make that mistake again. Until last September, when we were heading over to Scotland. We're in the cab. My wife asks me, so, you've got my passport, right? No, I thought you had it. Well, at least we figured this out before we hit the airport. So the cab driver makes an illegal U-turn across the tollway median, and we sprint back home to find the passport sitting on my desk. It was now only a 15-minute backtrack this time, so we still got to O'Hare in time to get a sandwich at Tortas Frontera. But it was a wake-up call. Never, never be complacent about stupidity. We were in San Francisco, my wife and I, a few weekends back, and it's always an interesting time in San Francisco, especially when about 80,000 people decide to march through the center of town on a Saturday. We were staying at the Westin St. Francis on Union Square, decided to go old school for the weekend. It rained most of that weekend, which emptied out the cab rank outside of the St. Francis, which meant we did more ride shares and less cabs, and because of the rain, less walking. Now, I have both Uber and Lyft on my phone, so I'd pop them open, compare the wait times and the pricing. And even with the rain, the wait time rarely topped 3 minutes, which I got to tell you, feels like almost instantaneous given the traffic around Union Square. I was just amazed at the number of sort of animated cars swarming the area that you could see on each app. So continuing my research from a couple of episodes ago, I'd talk with each of the drivers about, you know, how their gig was going. And I was surprised, actually, at the overwhelming preference for Lyft over Uber. Lyft pays more than Uber, I was told, and many of the drivers actually said they only take Uber rides when they think they can hit Uber's incentive bonuses. And if they can't, then they'll just take Lyft. And they said that the Lyft riders tended to be nicer and more considerate. Now, I didn't quite know what to do with that since I was using both apps. So I'm both a Uber rider and a Lyft rider. And I think I'm the same person no matter whether I'm, you know, popping the, you know, the black button or the pink button. Well, anyhow, so our Sunday morning driver told us that he drives solely for Lyft, that he quit after they trialed driverless cars in San Francisco. He said it was just another proof point that Uber just doesn't care about its drivers. And actually, it's funny, we just ended up taking Lyft most of that weekend. And it was, and when I thought back on it, it really echoed what I had heard from a driver in Charlottesville, Virginia, that does both Uber and Lyft. This guy was a super driver. He had driven 85,000 miles in the last 12 months. And he said he also preferred Lyft because they paid more, but that he gets more rides from Uber just because they've got brand awareness. So he lives in Charlottesville, but then he heads over to drive in Richmond when UVA is on break. And actually that coming weekend was going to be an inaugural weekend in D.C. And so he was planning to drive up for the inauguration because he figured that the surge pricing would make it worth his while. I tell you, I've never talked to a guy who has been working the system as hard as this guy. Now, it's funny, back home, when we're telling our son Andrew about this, he comes completely down firmly on Uber's side. He said, because Uber can't cancel a ride. My son said he's had way too many Chicago Lyft drivers cancel rides on him. And so he's just completely deleted the Lyft app off his phone and is exclusively Uber. Last month, I was flying one of my usual routes, actually back from the 1990s, O'Hare to Detroit Metro, and I was doing it complete with the original aircraft, an American Airlines MD-80. That was a bit of a blast from the past. That sort of, you know, 2-3-seat cabin configuration, 2 on one side, 3 on the other, and what now seems like kind of half-height overhead bins, and they're kind of shorter on the two sides, so you can't put it in wheels first on the two side. You know, at least, though, it was one of the original American MD-80s, not one of the TWA ones that they picked up after that merger. The American ones are actually not a bad plane if you're toward the front of the plane, away from the engines in the back. They seem to have more rows of the, you know, the extra legroom, main cabin, extra seats. So you've got more of a shot at getting some extra legroom than actually their new A319s or A320s. And at some point during the flight, my roommate looks kind of down at my phone, and she says, "How are you charging your phone? There aren't any plugs here." And of course, she's used to kind of the regular AC 3-prong plugs that are in the newer planes, the A319s, A320s, and the 737-800s. She was kind of right. The MD-80s don't have those kind of plugs, and they're not sitting right in front of you. But I knew from years of flying these planes, and I first started flying American in 1985 when these MD-80s were actually brand new, and down between the seats, you can find an old cigarette lighter style outlet. Now, I actually still carry a lighter power adapter for that sort of 10% of the time that Hertz sticks me with a beater rental that doesn't have the built-in USB plug, or for the times like this when I'm flying American's beater airplanes. Hey, and if you've got any thoughts, questions, a story, a comment, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along the email address, comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com, like Dan Gradwell. You can use your smartphone to record and send an audio comment. Haven't had one of those in a while. Send a Twitter message to M. Peacock. I get a few of those. Thank you guys very much. Post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page, or you can always go old school, like Robert Fennerty, and post your thoughts on the website at travelcommons.com. So the first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is critiquing my top 10 travel tips. Look, every couple of years, I bow to the search engine gods at Google and create a listicle, that awful mashup word of list and article. They're kind of clickbaity. You know, you see them on places like Mashable, you know, top 10 ways to hack your morning routine, or the top most cringeworthy advertising fails of 2015. And by the way, I didn't make up those names. Those are real Mashable listicles. But they exist because people search for them. So in December, when my last listicle rolled off the front page of the Travel Commons website, I created another one, titled just like the last one, Top 10 Holiday Travel Tips. And how do they score? Well, I just searched just before recording this, and I searched for Top 10 Holiday Travel Tips. And it's funny, a Google Plus posting from my 2013 edition of Travel Tips made the first page of the results, albeit the last entry. And then last December, so December 2016, the most recent, made the top of the second page. So not too bad, not great, but not bad. When I write each new edition, I do try to think about what are today's top 10, not just sort of blindly copy-pasting the last post, although there is a good bit of repetition. I mean, fly nonstop and skip the tight connection. I mean, those tips are as valid today as they were 12 years ago when I started this podcast, though they might also seem a bit obvious to even a slightly seasoned traveler. So I have tried to weave in a few, if not pro tips, then at least sort of the next level of insight. So like in 2013, I suggested buying status for the lead adult in the travel party. The rationale goes like this. For $20, you can take your whole family through the status security line and early boarding because I've never seen a security screener or a gate agent split up a family. Now that one felt like it wasn't intuitively obvious. I've also consistently recommended that people use Twitter as an alternate path into customer service, almost like a concierge service, at addressing an airline or hotel as a way to jump what might be a long queue in front of a gate agent or a front desk clerk. I don't think a lot of folks realize kind of the sophistication and focus that many travel companies put on monitoring social media. My tweet about that American MD-80 generated a quick reply from American, "Mark, we're currently working on updating our fleet," and which I hadn't really, I didn't think I was being that snarky. And while not exactly travel-related, AT&T has now followed up with me twice over Twitter about a cellular service problem that I was having last week. Now, I gave this advice, use Twitter as a concierge service, to a friend who called me from O'Hare on Christmas Day. Korean Air wouldn't let him and his family board their flight to Hanoi because they didn't have Vietnamese visas. And this was a new requirement that had just hit sort of a couple of days earlier. Everybody else, and even when we went, it was always you could just buy them there in the airport at Ho Chi Minh City or Hanoi. And of course, it being Christmas Day, they couldn't find anyone to help them. So between the @tweeting and I think just sheer persistence, they finally found a way to get on that plane. I used to bring a portable battery pack, like a lipstick charger or something like that, or bring a small power strip. I used to have those on my list because just the sheer dearth of electrical outlets in airports. One listener at one point recommended stalking cleaning crews to find the hidden outlets. But now, finally, with some long overdue gate area refreshes, airlines are adding accessible outlets, either in new work areas and, especially Southwest does some nice things with sort of stool seating and flat areas with lots of outlets that you can pop open your laptop and charge things. And so those work areas, or I've seen a lot of these power pylons, and they tend to be either sponsored. A lot of them have been sponsored by Samsung. I see Verizon sponsoring some. I've seen it mostly in Newark Airport. But anyhow, it just seems that now finally there's enough. There's never enough power outlets, but at least you're not sort of crawling around on your hands and knees looking behind chairs. So, while I still carry a battery pack and I often find it useful, it's fallen out of the top 10 because I don't think it's as critical anymore. Back in 2014, I did break up sort of the monotony a little bit. Instead of a classic top 10 listicle, I offered airport etiquette tips. Things like when traveling with your family, don't stroll 4 abreast down the concourse. And the airport Starbucks isn't like your neighborhood Starbucks. Keep your coffee order to 3 adjectives or less. That article is nowhere to be found on Google's search page. So let me ask you guys, what is your top travel pro tip that you're going to be handing out to your friends as they get ready to go to spring break or later on for summer vacation? Sending one in, or actually posting one on the Travel Commons website, will be part of the giveaway that I'll announce in the next topic. So the second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is reviewing VPNs. Back in episode 119, I talked about digital security on the road, and the topic has turned into sort of a persistent thread across episodes, which makes sense given sort of the Chinese water torture type steady drip, drip, drip of cyber breach announcements. I mean, frequent travelers could be considered a high-risk group because being away from their homes and offices, we rely heavily on public networks, airports, hotels, Starbucks, to work and play in today's digitized, economy, society, street corner, whatever it is, we use a lot of public networks. So VPNs, virtual private networks, have really two main use cases for the frequent traveler: privacy on public networks and location shifting. So VPNs accomplish these by altering the routing of the network traffic in and out of your PC, tablet, smartphone. What you're putting out onto the internet is encrypted so that eavesdroppers, like the guy wearing the hoodie in the dark corner of the Starbucks, to play around in stereotypes, running a packet sniffer, can't read what you're browsing or emailing. And then the VPN routes your encrypted traffic so that it looks like you're using the internet from a different location, what's called the VPN endpoint. So how much privacy do you really need? And is it worth the additional hassle of using a VPN? Like everything, it depends. And being a consultant, you'll forgive me for giving into my reflex for distilling things down, any problem down into a 2x2 matrix. And really kind of the two dimensions of that 2x2 matrix are: what are you doing and how paranoid are you? So, you know, in the low paranoid, high privacy need box, I put things like online banking and filling out your global entry app. I mean, there's lots of personal information there that you don't want Mr. Hoodie to hoover up and post on sort of some dark web hacking website. In the low privacy need, high paranoid box, I'll put reading Mashable listicles or browsing porn sites. Embarrassing if somebody posted that info on your Facebook page, but they couldn't drain your bank account with it. The location shifting use case, sort of I'm in Beijing, but the internet thinks I'm in Chicago, only really comes into play, I think, for international travelers, like when I'm in Madrid, but I'm wanting to stream the NCAA basketball tournament, or when my daughter in Scotland wants to watch Friends reruns. Don't ask me why she wants to do that, but which I guess is only available, according to her, only available on the U.S. Netflix. So I'll also use VPNs when, say, I am in Beijing to hit Facebook and Twitter, which are blocked by the Great Firewall of China. Now, I looked at two highly rated software VPNs, the guys that normally bubble up to the top of the evaluation lists: Private Internet Access, oftentimes abbreviated as PIA, amazingly so, and NordVPN. And then I also looked at a hardware-based VPN product, Always Home, that started as a Kickstarter campaign. And if you recall, I reviewed that. I reviewed Always Home back in episode 124. And I just kind of throw it in there just actually for a contrast between software and hardware. So PIA and NordVPN are pretty quick to set up. You go to the website, you buy a subscription. Now, the promotions are going to change all the time, but when I'm writing this or right before I recorded this, I checked online. PIA has discounted their annual subscription to $40, while NordVPN's is at $79, so it's not a big number. You download, install, run their software, what's called a VPN client, pick a VPN endpoint, which country do you want the internet to think you're coming from, and then off you go. But the next time you access the internet, you need to remember to do the same thing all over again, to start the client, pick an endpoint, unless you set the client to automatically log you in each time you start up. Now, Always Home, the hardware VPN, takes a bit more planning, right? Because you've got to buy and get delivered a pair of USB dongles. And then when you do that, you also buy the service subscription. Right now, all in, according to the website, it's $180 for the dongles and a year's subscription. You plug one of the dongles into your home router. I've got it plugged into my UVerse router. And then you take the second with you, in your laptop bag. And then you use that when you're on the road. So I tested the software VPNs on three platforms, a Windows 10 PC that was hardwired into a network, a Samsung tablet running Android 6.0.1, the Marshmallow instance, and that was on Wi-Fi, and then my iPhone 7 running the most recent iOS, I think it's like 10.2, on Wi-Fi, and also on AT&T's LTE mobile data. So I first looked at the performance, sort of how much speed was I going to be giving up for the additional encryption and routing that gives me the privacy. The Windows PC had the lowest penalty. Both VPNs cut upload and download speeds by about 6%. They also had about the same on the iPhone on Wi-Fi, though the download penalty increased to about 11%. I don't know if this is an iOS limitation or something else, but it's kind of consistent across both. Now, on the Android tablet on Wi-Fi, Nord VPN's download was about on par with the Windows PC, about a 6% hit. While the PIA Android client, it was 25% slower on downloads than without the VPN. So that one's got to be marked down to the PIA's Android client. Now, an interesting result was on the iPhone on the AT&T LTE service, so on the cellular mobile service, the download penalty on LTE was like 83% for both Nord and PIA. So there's something going on with AT&T's 4G LTE service. And while it's interesting, it's probably the least practical value that, other than the triple paranoid people, I'm not sure why someone would tack a VPN onto their cellular connection. At least I don't. I pretty much just use it for Wi-Fi and hotels. Now, accessing U.S. Netflix from abroad is kind of the acid test for location shifting. Netflix, and really kind of, I think they got the stick from their content suppliers. Netflix has been the most aggressive service in blocking VPN endpoints, blocking people from outside the U.S., streaming content that Netflix only has licenses to in the U.S., if that makes any sense. So I asked my daughter, Claire, who's at University of St. Andrews in the UK, to test each VPN with her Netflix friends test. PIA failed. Netflix served up its standard blocked screen. NordVPN went through, let her log into the U.S. Netflix site, and she was able to watch Friends, though she said the connection was slow. Now, this is probably the result of lousy BT service coming into her flat over a chip shop. But Always Home actually did the best. The hardware VPN did the best. No Netflix blocking because it looked like she was logging in from our house. And it had the best connection over the lousy BT service because it's hardware. The Always Home hardware does some network acceleration. It accelerates network traffic in a way that the software VPNs can't. So I also asked Claire, a bit of a novice, for her thoughts on the NordVPN and PIA software clients. She liked the NordVPN client better, more graphical, easier to understand. The PIA client is a bit more stripped down. But she also liked that with the Always Home VPN, the hardware solution, she didn't have to install any software on her PC. She just connected to the Always Home Wi-Fi network. So sorting it all out, if you want an easy VPN solution that allows you to use Netflix when you're overseas, go with NordVPN. If you want the cheapest solution that's a bit more stripped down, and you're not worried about Netflix, and you're not running Android, then go with PIA. But if you want the best Netflix experience from, say, a vacation rental that you're going to be at for a while and doesn't require you to navigate Wi-Fi login pages, and you can plan a couple of weeks ahead, then try Always Home. Now for the giveaway. NordVPN has given me a year subscription to give away to one lucky Travel Commons listener. So go to the Travel Commons website and check out the top post to enter. It'll be open for 10 days from the posting of this episode, which, if I've got my calendar math right, is probably about, I think it's like March 2nd. So come by the website. And I'm actually using Rafflecopter, and again, it's more of a raffle, and I'll use Rafflecopter to select a random winner after the 10 days. So come by the website, you know, enter, and hey, got a shot to be more cyber secure this year. And as always, thanks again to the folks at NordVPN for this giveaway. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 127. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Check out the show notes for music links. You can find Travel Commons, as always, on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher. And if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, or to mpeacock at Twitter. Write them on the Travel Commons Facebook page. Post them on the website at travelcommons.com. And again, thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, and post comments on the website. Even if I don't get them onto the show, I really do appreciate them. So, hey, swing by. Enter the VPN giveaway if you're interested. And again, thanks to NordVPN for that. And until we talk again, safe travels, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.